Radio City, John Grayson and Rob Ross at it again against our better judgment. But, you know, here we are. It's a new week and it's gotten cold here. And here, of course, is just outside the city of St. Louis in southern Illinois. Rob, is it? Are you freezing your balls off yet? What's going on in New York?
Actually, it's seasonably cold. That's all I can say about it. It's, you know, yesterday and today were sunny and, you know, about 47 degrees. Friday was just the crappy day of the week. It just rained really hard in the middle of the afternoon all the way through into the late evening. Beyond that, it's been pretty nice. I mean, last week, earlier in the week, you know, around the last time that we spoke, we were looking at about 57 to 60 degrees each day.
Not bad.
So far, so good. I mean, I heard that New Jersey got some snow this weekend, which is odd, but I'm glad we've escaped it thus far. Anyway, how was your week, John?
Oh.
Tell us, what did you do?
It has been unbelievably, you know, for an unemployed dude, I'm awfully damn busy. So, something funny happened on the way to the kitchen the other morning. My phone rang, and if you listen to last week's show, you already know I'm looking for a gig. Did what you do. Just started calling everybody I know, and I was very happy to see that some calls came in unsolicited from people who had just heard. You know, guys I knew 20 years ago who had heard what happened through some of the industry rags, like Radio and Records and All Access and all that. And so they wanted to reach out and say, hey, man, anything I can do to help? And they've sent lists of program directors and all of this. So that was great and completely unexpected. So on the heels of all of that, Thursday morning, my phone rang and it was the program director, a gentleman by the name of Alan First, very nice guy, at KMBZ Radio in Kansas City. And he said, can you do my evening show today? And I said, sure, why not? And this was one night after our last Radio City went up live, or one night before, rather. It was one night after I had done the Spoon podcast with Robbie Rist from the Brady Bunch and Tom Bowers and Chris Jackson, three great guys. And that was a lot of fun. Also got invited to a movie podcast called The Spoon, or not The Spoon, the other one, a movie podcast called Real Spoilers with my friend Tom O'Keefe, and it's just been nonstop. So between that and it ended up extending out to two nights in Kansas City, Thursday night and Friday night on KMBZ, and had an absolute blast there. That was so much fun, and it's nice to see that there's a radio station still in talk radio outside of where I was that doesn't do the stock standard political BS, you know, just the constant drumbeat of right-wing politics are the only politics, right-wing. But they don't do any of that stuff. It's all lifestyle radio, and the station sounds fantastic. It was a real pleasure to just kind of slide in there and have fun on a Thursday and Friday night.
Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Because that was, you know, when I heard the news, I thought that was absolutely terrific that you were going to be able to do this very quickly. And, you know, yeah, you are a busy dude. I mean, you did the Facebook Live, you did the Spoon, you did the movie podcast, and of course, Radio City, which is your highest of priority.
Of course it is.
Because you're the co-star of the show, so, you know.
Right.
Don't forget, you're your own boss here.
Right, and when it's got our names on it, then yeah, it's always going to be a slightly higher priority. But then, yeah, last week's show went up, and we've gotten great response from that as well. So, yeah.
I think we're on to something here.
Yeah, 89 episodes in, and we're finally hitting stride.
They like us. They really like us.
Oh, man. But it is. It's an interesting proposition. Nobody ever wants to lose a job, but you learn a lot of things about the state of your industry and who your friends are and all of that stuff when you lose one. And this is the first time, because I haven't lost a job in 20 years up till I've left jobs, but I haven't lost one in almost 20 years now. So it was, it was a very different proposition this time around.
Well, glad to see that things are beginning to definitely look up. And for a year that was fraught with a lot of frustration, not just for you, but for me and a lot of other people, this is kind of a positive way to start the trajectory upward. As we always want to say, you know, when it's been a good year, it's a good year. When it's a bad year, we're looking forward to the next one.
Right.
You know, Thanksgiving is coming up. You know, the holidays are coming up. So it puts everything into a very positive spin and perspective, especially with the fact that we just managed to survive, drumroll please, Erection Day.
Oh, yeah. And survive is a great way to put it. I mean, there's so much out there that people have been crying in their beer over and throwing tantrums over and making themselves look ridiculous about. But there are also some little things that didn't really get reported on much that don't make sense. And we'll get into that part of the electorate in just a little bit. But I know you wanted to start out with something that, because I kind of hit you out of the blue with or in our head segment last week, there were some things, and this always happens. We see them pop up on our page on Popdos, and we have things that occur to us over the course of the week that we go, damn, I should have thought of that one.
Well, in this case, it was the minute that you and I hung up yet again.
Of course.
As soon as I walked out of the room, I'm like, oh, fuck. I just remembered I forgot somebody.
Yep.
Because the topic that we were talking about is, well, yours was very specific at the outset. It was, you know, singing in character of somebody else.
Right.
But we expanded it to the whole sing, speak delivery of a song. And I forgot. First of all, we were talking about the Police, and I was talking about Stuart Copeland specifically. And you did put On Any Other Day into the last episode of Radio City. But I forgot Andy Summers, of course, did Friends, which was, I think, one of the best things that he'd ever contributed to the band, which is notoriously hilarious, but it's in that croak of his, that patented Andy Summers croak, that whole, I likes to eat my friends, you know, make no bones about it. I like to eat my friends, I cannot live without it. Tain't a man nor poet friend, I know just how you'll taste. Your limbs go sliding down my throat and never go to waste. How could I forget that? That's number one, because we were talking about the Police. Number two, one of the best lyricists, bar none, of the last, let's say, in the entire span of the rock and roll era, the guy who, to me, put true intellectualism back into lyrical poetry, Lloyd Cole is the master of the sing speak.
Yes.
But he does it in such a smooth and fluid way, whether it's, you know, delivering something like the lyrics to Perfect Skin.
Shame on you, got no sense of grace, shame on me. Just in case I might come to a conclusion other than that which is absolutely necessary, and that's perfect skin.
To the outright preconceived pretentiousness, deliberate pretentiousness of Sean Penn Blues, to the hysterical lyrics of My Bag, Lloyd Cole is the master of the sing speak. So
yeah.
I wanted to give him props and a shout out because I love the guy. He's brilliant beyond words.
Right. And and there's another one that because, and we'll do another in our heads at the end of this segment as well, but because you brought up the song by the Police, in listening to that, there were echoes and I was remembering something not quite. You know, I could kind of hear it, but I couldn't quite put a finger on what it was. And what it was a song off of the soundtrack to one of my favorite movies of the 1980s, Repo Man. And The Modern Lovers with Pablo Picasso was Never Called an Asshole.
Now the girls have turned the color of an avocado when he drive down the street in his Eldorado. Why, he was only 5'3". Girls could not resist his stare. Pablo Picasso was never called an asshole.
That one is spoken all the way through it. It's just telling a story, sort of in beat, but definitely not any discernible melody on top of the thing. But it's a great tune.
And Jonathan Richman is a wit.
Yes,
so,
right.
A true wit. Without being pretentious about it, and that's what you got to love about the guy.
Indeed. We also had a little football, and I'm not doing this just to rub your nose in it, I swear, Rob, because both of us are bottom dwellers in the AFC East right now, but the Bills played at New York earlier today, and I'm not sure the Jets were there.
I can tell you they weren't.
What happened?
They didn't show up. I swear to God, I think they're trying to get the coach fired. It's just that simple. I've got no other answer for it.
Yeah.
You know, Todd Bowles is in trouble. He does not have any control over this team. Either it's him not able to be a coach the way these guys need to be coached, or it's the team are just so inept.
Yeah. And you could tell, when the game started to get out of control, you could tell by looking at his face that whether or not he gets fired, because you got the bye week coming up same as we do, right? So we're off for the next 2 weeks. And you could tell that as soon as it started to slide out of control and it went up to 24-0, that he was watching his own job just wither away. And whether or not he gets fired over the next 2 weeks, he thinks he's going to. And I mean, the bye week isn't a bad time to do it if you're going to do it.
See, the thing is, you know, if you're in New York, you understand pain because all the sports franchises here are abysmal. And that's not hyperbole. That's a fact. The Jets are terrible. The Giants are worse. I'm happy to say that. Okay. The Rangers are middling to mediocre at best. This is a team that really doesn't know how to hold on to a lead very tightly. They had a lead going into the last minute on Friday night against Detroit. They were leading 2-1, and they blew that lead, and then they lost in overtime to the Red Wings when they shouldn't have. Last night, the Rangers had a 3-1 lead over Columbus in the second period of last night's game. They gave up that lead. Columbus passed them. It's 4-3. In the last minute of the period, the Rangers tie it. They had to go to a shootout. The Rangers shockingly won, but that doesn't say anything to me. I think they're maybe at 500 right now. The Islanders are just getting by, not that I really care. The Devils are mediocre. The Knicks are terrible. The Nets are terrible. You know, we just had a very bad baseball season, obviously, as a Met fan. The Yankees, I don't care about. They're persona non grata. You suffer when you're me in New York when it comes to sports. It's that simple.
Right. And unfortunately, I mean, everybody in Buffalo knows suffering is a part of the game for us as well. So as we move away from the sports world and into what happened last Tuesday election day and into the evening, I've started, and I want to start with a little bit on the news on this, and then we'll talk about what actually went down. I've started really detesting election day because it's about the worst television up until the polls start closing. It's about the worst possible television you could imagine because you have a breaking news story that's a very important story, and you know exactly when it's coming. So all day long, you can't help but talk about it, and yet there's nothing to say. Because there's no results. There's all, you know, all you have is the latest round of the latest speculation from the latest talking heads, and it amounts to absolutely nothing. It is terrible, terrible television and radio for that matter, right up until 7 o'clock or 7:30 Eastern time, when all of the real fun starts. But man, I wish that they would just act like it's any other news day until the polls close. Put the clock on there and screw it. Go do your jobs.
Fake news. Fake news.
Yeah, right.
My problem with it all is the fact that they always seem to call these races before the polls are even closed.
Yeah.
That's about as dishonest as you can get.
Right.
I'm sorry. I've got a big problem with that. But, you know, I don't know how much of a ripple effect there was across the country, but I'm in Staten Island, which is, for all intents and purposes, the Republican stronghold of the New York City area. And we had one shocker here, and that is Congressman Dan Donovan, who is the Republican incumbent, lost, might I say handily, by about 6 points to upstart Max Rose, who is a Democrat. He's a veteran, and unfortunately, he's a Bernie Sanders disciple. And that's where I have a major problem with him. I don't care that he's a practicing Orthodox Jew. I'm all well and good for that. Yay. I don't give a shit. He's a Bernie guy. I got a problem with that. But people are sitting there scratching their heads. How could Dan Donovan have lost? It's very simple. For whatever your political stripes are, you have to give credit to Max Rose if you watched him campaign, because he was out there actively campaigning day after day after day. He was in the ferry terminal several days a week. He was on the streets of various parts of Staten Island. We're talking about the area that I grew up in, which is in the South Shore. That is the reddest part of the island, and he was out there pressing flesh and meeting people.
Yep.
Max Rose ran campaign ads. Dan Donovan ran maybe one ad, I think. I didn't see him at any time. He did not do anything that remotely looked like a campaign that he cared about winning. I don't know if it was bravado in presuming it was automatic that he'd win, or could it be that he just didn't want to do it anymore and didn't care if he won?
Yeah. Well, either way, I mean, the easiest way to lose a race like that is to assume you can't lose a race like that, Hillary. You know, just assume you have it in the bag and find out you're about to get boned.
Bernie.
Right.
Now, of course, in New York, that piece of shit Ocasio-Cortez won her little seat, which means absolutely nothing in the overall scheme of things. But almost as quickly as she won, she's shooting her mouth off because some report of about her rent situations. We all know she's full of shit. So, you know, she's just starting off on a great note. But I don't want to see that bug-eyed lunatic, you know, being lauded as being anything special. Unfortunately, we're going to have a lot of that because, as I was going to say, I want to give a quick shout out with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek to everyone who is just busy patting themselves on the back collectively on Tuesday after they went out and voted, or Wednesday saying, I voted. That's number one. Good for you.
Yeah, nicely done.
Aren't you special? That's number one. Number two, for all of you whining, crying babies on Tuesday night who were having massive tantrums and hissy fits because Beto O'Rourke didn't win in Texas, first of all, sober up. Second of all, grow up.
Yep.
Third of all, you don't live in Texas. What part of this don't any of you get?
Yeah. Well, they got their rock star, or at least they thought they did, and then they found out he's actually not a rock star. So, yeah, it's having that ripped away from you that they're all crying about. But you make the absolute perfect point. Where most of this is coming from is outside the state of Texas. And if you deluded yourself into thinking that because he's tall and good-looking and Ted Cruz is a little troll asshole, that it meant that a Democrat could win a Senate seat in Texas, that's your fault for deluding yourself.
Well, it's just ignorance across the board, because the way people talk about this, if you read the conversations, there is no conversation. It's just them, I think, memorizing a script, so to speak.
Right.
They're all memorizing the bullet points that they've read over and over. No, sorry. I take that back. Not the bullet points that they've read, but the bullet points that they have now become brainwashed by. Because the left loves rhetoric. They love to make their talking points, pound their fists on the podium, and spew forth all their gospel, because you know how they are about everything.
Sure.
The moral righteousness.
The sanctimony, yes.
Yes, yes. I didn't want to go down. Okay, that's a stronger word, and it's the right word. But look, they're also getting all up in the, you know, a collective hard-on of the fact that, ooh, now Maxine Waters can tangle with Donald Trump. No, because she's as dumb as a fucking rock. You've got one moron going against a very clever moron, one who's been really successful at dodging every bullet, and I dare say the Teflon Don will not be swayed by the likes of a babbling lunatic like Maxine Waters. She's embarrassed herself enough times. I have a novel concept for all of you in Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike. All of you, shut the fuck up and go to work, because that's what we're all paying you to do. Our tax dollars pay for your jet set lifestyles.
Well, they've got to protect their phony baloney jobs. So, I'm with you. But see, the thing that bothers me, even though, as I've pointed out many, many times before, I don't live in Missouri, but I'm Missouri adjacent. What happens in St. Louis matters to me in a very real way, at least for the time being. Who knows what it's going to be like a week from now. So in the midst of all of this, I was watching very closely what happened, because Illinois was pretty easy to predict. You
predicted it a month ago, actually. You called it a month ago.
Yeah, that Pritzker was going to beat Rauner's ass. And so that was, yeah, I mean, that wasn't that going far out on a limb. But with Missouri, and I called this one too, even though everybody was saying, oh, it's a razor-fine margin between Claire McCaskill and Josh Hawley. I told you, Josh Hawley's going to beat her in a walk, and he did. But what kills me about that is less about the candidates and more about the appearances of it all when you have a state that votes overwhelmingly in favor of a law now that will allow for medical marijuana. And in that same state, you have an overwhelming majority vote in favor of raising the minimum wage from $7.35 an hour now, up to $12 an hour by 2021, which is only 3 years away. So you have all of these progressive steps that are taken by the same voters who put a Republican in the Senate, who put a Republican in the governor's office last time around, who put Republican state reps and U.S. reps all over the place. I mean, it's about as red as you can possibly get for a bunch of people who are voting for politicians who will actively work against what the voters said they wanted.
And that, my friend, is the big crux of our modern voting age. And by the way, do we know what the numbers were for, you know, the young people's vote that everybody was ballyhooing about?
Not yet. It was up, but it wasn't up by the numbers that they hoped it would be.
The self-aggrandizing little shits out there. And,
right.
They're out there, you know, still patting themselves on the back. No, you know, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear one thing from any of you because you're the reason we're all in this world of shit right now. So
right.
Now let's talk about a couple of other quick little bullet points that we have because we always like to go through our little list of things.
Of course.
One, I'm going to give a big thumbs up to somebody whose name I've never brought up before, Pamela Anderson.
I can't wait to hear why.
Very simple. She slammed the whole Me Too movement. Good for you, girl.
What'd she say?
She said that they go way too far and way too overboard, that they're too busy trying to destroy people's lives when they don't have the facts to present.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm all for that. You go, girl.
Definitely.
So that's number one. Number two, 50 years ago, not the White Album, the premiere of Head.
Yes. This is one we can spend some time with because we've talked before about anniversaries and how a lot of this stuff gets very overwrought and very involved in itself. But it's the ones that we don't mark that are the ones that end up, you know, being those little bits and pieces of pop culture history that mean the most to us. And that movie, I mean, even without the movie, if that soundtrack album had never come out, if all they had ever done is release a 45 of the Porpoise song, it would have been one of the best things to happen in 1968. Yeah, we got the entire soundtrack, we got that entire movie, and it was just golden from word go. And I don't know what else to say about it. There's so much heart in that movie. There's so much satire. There's so much wit in that movie that anybody who has never seen the Monkees movie Head, I don't know what you're waiting for. I mean, go, do it now. You can listen to the rest of our podcast when you're done.
The thing is that Head was not only done with a lot of heart, it was done in such a really, truly intellectual fashion without being pretentious or precious.
Right.
You know, it lampooned the Monkees themselves, obviously, but the fact that it was very much of the moment, it really encapsulated the way the world had gone in the span of 1 year's time, from the whole peace and love thing to the activism in war, you know, and the divide of us versus them on every front, whether it was black and white, young and old, you know, hippie and you know, what did the hippies fight against? Like the man, you know?
Right.
It's a brilliant piece of work. The dialogue is magnificent. Easily one of the five most memorable and easily quotable movies of all time, without a doubt.
Yep.
Soundtrack, forget it. The Porpoise song, Circle Sky, Can You Dig It? Long title, Do I Have to Do This All Over Again? You know, come on. Daddy's song, their version of Harry Nilsson's Daddy's song. Just absolutely out of sight. Brilliant, every level. Even a dipshit like Steven Spielberg loves that movie.
Yeah, and it took even its own self-referential and outside referential nature and went to the best places you could possibly imagine, because the whole Coke machine scene, I think you may have been the one that told me about this, the Coke machine scene in Head was directly influenced by the Coke machine scene in Dr. Strangelove. That's where that concept kind of was born, and then the Monkees just expanded it in their own direction.
They spoofed, they lampooned, they reported is what they did.
Right.
You know, that's really what they were doing.
The money's you know, we're made of tin. We're here to give you more.
Right down to the fact that they lampoon themselves, like in the scene with Annette Funicello.
Right.
You know, where you know, Davey's going to go and fight, you know, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
yeah, and they gave us Terry Garr. They gave us Terry Garr, man. I mean, come on. Sure, her first line in any movie was in that movie, and the line was, "Quick, suck it before the poison reaches my heart."
I don't want to do this anymore. Come on, man. Come on.
I'll be in my bunk. Oh, God. So, yeah.
You know who the dance partner for Davy Jones was? That was Tony Basil. So
right. Yeah, and that was... That's how she is. Okay, so let me see if I get the chronology right. So that's how she ended up in Easy Rider. Or did I get that backwards?
Yes.
Okay,
no,
so
you got it right.
Yeah, so she... right, because Nicholson was instrumental in getting Head made in the first place, so then he took her and put her in Easy Rider with Peter Fonda.
Nicholson was the co-writer of Head. And if you see the scene when they're in the commissary after Peter punches... Mr. and Mrs. Ace, he gets up and he walks out through the door, and then he's like calling for the makeup guy. Nicholson walks by.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I mean, Head is just such a brilliant, visually stunning thing. It really is. This is a must movie for everyone. It's like seeing Clockwork Orange or Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those pivotal movies that everyone should see. It should be assigned in classrooms.
Yeah, just an utterly fantastic piece of work. And now, on the other hand, I mean, we have movie documentaries. We have movie pseudo-documentaries. We've got, you know, This is Spinal Tap and that whole bit of noise. And, of course, we have the biopics. And there's one that's in the theaters right now, still doing a decent bit of business. And as a matter of fact, my lovely bride and I saw it today. We went out and spent a couple of bucks to go see Bohemian Rhapsody. And, you know, in terms of just bare movie making, sure, it's a good story. Unfortunately, it is not Queen's story. There's so much that's wrong in this movie, I don't even know where to start.
Well, that's the problem I have with acted out films. First of all, we live in a day and age where documentaries now are plentiful. So if you want to get a full scope perspective from whatever angle of a band's history or an individual's history, you'll find it.
Right.
You know, you will find them. And there's been more than enough ample and I would say solid documentary work done on Queen and on Freddie Mercury himself, if you're going to separate the man from the band. Now, I think Rami Malek's a very good actor. I liked his performances in Mr. Robot, which the show itself lost me after the first season, because it, like so many others, went up its own ass. But he's a riveting performer. He really is. I think he did something of a Herculean performance playing somebody like Freddie Mercury, who is such a wealth of contradiction.
Right.
But I hate acted stories about bands. There's never a need for them. And that goes from the movie, the TV versions of these, you know, biopics to screen versions. And there's never a need for a screen version. You know, I think the biggest offensive, the most offensive one I've seen as of yet was Daydream Believers, The Story of the Monkees, which was a TV thing.
Right.
But it was just so horrifically done. And what you just said struck such a loud chord with me that they got so much about Queen wrong.
Yeah, and I mean, we can start with the fact that this was very much a Freddie Mercury movie. Now, Rami Malek, for as you said, he's a fantastic actor. He does this kind of drama very well, and he comes off well. He acquits himself well as Freddie Mercury. The problem is that if the story that you're telling, which is kind of what they try to do with this movie, is that Queen is much more than just Freddie Mercury, then you're going to have to go into the story of some of the other band members, and they don't. It's only about Freddie. And, you know, you get the sort of knowing glances from the other band members, but you really get no sense as to what they mean.
Well, that's very true. I mean, you know, the one guy who in that band I found always to be the most interesting was Roger Taylor.
Right.
Because he's the drummer, which, of course, you're automatically negated to the background, but he's one of the main songwriters. He's a multi-instrumentalist. He's also the other voice, or the voice, if you will, that always took those Queen records to a higher level because of his octave range.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's a story in and of itself.
And in this movie, you know, they go into some of that. They go into some of his performances, but you know, at one point he comes in and says, "This is my wife." And then we never hear from her, you know, the entire time. She doesn't have a single line in the movie. She has no arc. He has no arc. It's just, "Well, I'm married now." And that's supposed to be representative of the fact that they all went off and had families and kids and all of that stuff away from Freddie while he was doing pounds and pounds and pounds of cocaine. Okay, but how about explore that just a little bit?
Well, that's the problem with 90% of all filmmaking.
Yep.
It's done in a half-baked manner. These films aren't thought through, and they just don't work by virtue of the fact that you'd be there for 4 hours if you're going to try and tell a more complete story, and you still won't be able to achieve that.
Right. Yeah, so it's, I mean, like I said, if all you want to do is go see a movie with some really cool sort of edited together, cobbled together concert footage and, you know, see Rami Malek in a tour de force as Freddie Mercury, then yeah, it's fine. But if what you really want is to get a director's view of what the story of Queen was all about, forget it. You're not going to get anywhere close.
I mean, question, they didn't have somebody else approximating the music. They just used the music of Queen. Correct?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Okay, because, you know, the one thing I appreciated about Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson movie, was that Paul Dano took on the unbelievable task of singing Brian Wilson's vocals. When you hear them in that studio setting, he's doing the actual singing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's no mean achievement. The thing is, he also looks a lot like a young Brian Wilson looked at the time. They screwed that movie up completely by having John Cusack play the role of the older Brian Wilson. I mean, that was just, that's about as far from reality as you can stray.
Like I said, I mean, it's your $10. If you really want to go waste it on this one, you can. I will say this. You're not going to miss a thing if you wait for this to come out on Netflix and watch it then. There is no, I mean, yeah, it's kind of neat to see Live Aid reconstructed at the end of this movie, which is where this all goes. And that's another kind of a piece of the problem with this, is that they make it seem like these guys hadn't seen each other for years before Live Aid. And clearly they had. I mean, they were recording together before that concert happened. So I don't know. I don't know what was the story there, but I guess they had to figure out a way to make the story more dramatic, which again is the problem with doing, as you said, this kind of movie.
Yeah, well, I had a feeling it wasn't. I don't itch for these kinds of films, and I've heard on more than one occasion, and of course it raises my hackles to no end, people talking about, oh, maybe now they should do a movie about Big Star. No! Here's a documentary! Right. Leave it! That's all you need. Yeah. You got the documentary. Have done with it.
Right. And you mentioned Brian Wilson. We'll go back into the movies and talk about another Wilson. And I'm glad I'm not the only one who just can't stomach Rebel Wilson. But it sounds like you can't either. And she found herself in the news this week. Go back to the beginning on this one, because I heard whispers about it. What happened?
She tweeted some kind of comment or made a comment about how she's the only plus-sized actress out there who's kind of been paving the way for plus-size actresses because she's out there so frequently. It's some kind of self-aggrandizing, self-congratulatory bullshit that just made everybody go, what? Now, first of all, if you don't know who she is, she's that loud, big-mouthed, obnoxious, nasally, gaudy, blonde Australian pain in the ass who thinks she's hysterical. If you've seen the stupid what's those stupid
yeah, the ones about the acapella singers, right? Yeah. Those.
She's the character called Fat Amy. Yeah, she's fat asshole. That's what she is. Okay, so she's this unfunny asshole, and she made these comments, and you know, rightfully so. There are a lot of, or were at one time, plus size actresses who decided to call her out for it, and I'm glad that they did.
Right. Pitch Perfect, by the way, is the name of the series of movies. So,
yeah, so completely pointless, you know, feel-good horseshit like they always crank out because they got to do 3 and 4 of these goddamn movies till the well runs dry, you know. She's an unfunny, untalented nothing, and she's never been anything, and she's not a star here, and she's a zilch.
Right.
And I'm very glad that, you know, actresses who've actually done something, who are on the, quote, bigger side, if you will, you know, called her out for it. It's like, honey, you aren't even a glint in your daddy's eye when I was out there.
Yeah, right. Well, and she was trying to make the case, I guess, that rom-coms are not, generally speaking, populated by anybody who isn't gorgeous. And there is a case to be made there, but to say I broke down the barriers when you didn't, especially when you go back and you figure, okay, who were the women who actually did break down those barriers and appeared in rom-coms as the lead, as plus-size actresses, and most of them are black. So, you know,
I'll tell you what, I'm sorry, but I remember one from the 80s, late 80s. It was one of Ricky Lake's first movies.
Yes.
When she was still very plus-size. I think it was called Baby Cakes, in which she gets Stephen Dorff.
Right.
A young Stephen, I think that's who it was, who was playing the lead against her.
But in more recent times, you have Queen Latifah and a bunch of other actresses. And so when Black Twitter, and I'm not, that's not my term to coin, but yeah, when they started catching on to this, they're the ones who went after her and went, excuse me, you're the first plus size actress to do what now? And she started blocking them. So, you know,
and then the peddling began too.
Right, exactly. Instead of being a grown up about the whole thing and saying, yeah, I fucked up, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said what I said, she started blocking people on Twitter and just being a total douche about the whole thing. But then again, who's surprised?
Right. Go back to Australia and don't come back to the United States. You're not needed because you're not fucking funny or entertaining.
Right.
Fuck off. Period.
Pretty
so
much.
That's that for her. So now that we've dispensed with another shit for brains, what do you call it? Let's see. The Girl Scouts are suing the Boy Scouts. Did you hear about this?
No.
Confusion over the name because the Boy Scouts, of course, were forced to change the name to Scouting. So people, I don't know what people, unless they're complete retards, think that they've merged.
Okay.
Now, I don't know anybody that – all I've heard over the past months since this bullshit began with the Boy Scouts being forced into admitting girls into the Boy Scouts, but the Girl Scouts keeping their status quo – you have to be a real fucking Nimrod to not be able to discern the Girl Scouts from the conceivable Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts.
Right.
I mean, for Christ's sakes, seriously, what the hell is wrong with everyone?
I don't know. You're not going to go – God, I don't even know where to start with this. First of all, I mean, the Boy Scouts themselves, I don't care. I mean, now that it's scouting or whatever, it just doesn't make any difference. It's still – you know, the organization itself has so many deep-seated issues, going back to the fact that, I mean, they tried to bitch and complain for how long about keeping this group out and that group out and making sure none of the Scoutmasters or none of the Scouts were gay and all of this nonsense. And, you know, they invite a bunch of politicians that I wouldn't give two shits for to come and speak to their little jamboree every year. And, you know, I never had any use for them. Honestly, I have a lot more respect in general for the Girl Scouts because they never got involved in any of that shit. It was just about what the Boy Scouts always say they're about, which is going out and learning how to do stuff and camp in the woods and tie knots and shit. That's what the Girl Scouts do. And they don't give a shit about anything else as far as social issues are concerned. And they go out and sell cookies, and they're pretty awesome cookies, and they leave everybody else alone. So
they're not awesome cookies because they too many of them have coconut. So
well,
forget.
Yeah, true.
Off my list.
But yeah, I mean, look, send your kids wherever you want to send your kids. I don't care. But when it gets into this kind of petty nonsense, I have no time for it.
You know what? I'm going to send my kids to military school so they can all man up. That way when I say march, you fucking march.
Exactly.
Or in my case, goose step.
Speaking of which, we should also make mention of the fact that as we are now finishing up this recording, it is no longer the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, the Armistice Day in 1918, which it was when we began this. It is now officially Veterans Day. And so for everybody who served in uniform, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather included in all of that. My great-grandfather, by the way, served in World War I, I just found out. And to all of them, a heartfelt thanks for what you did and what you sacrificed.
And same thing applies to my dad. Of course, he's no longer with us, but my dad, who served in Korea, my step-grandfather, who served in WW2, my uncle, who served in Vietnam, my other uncle, who served in the Coast Guard, and my beloved cousin, Zachary, who is serving right now in the Marines. So to all of them, of course, you have my heartfelt thanks.
Yeah,
and utmost appreciation and respect.
A little bit of interesting family history, as a matter of fact, with that, because my great-grandfather, who was Scottish, so he was serving in His Majesty's Army at that point, served in 1917 and 1918 in what is now Israel, what then was called Palestine. So
don't use that word. Don't ever use that word on this show.
Just a matter of history, ever. Man.
Just call it the P word, but don't you ever use that word.
But he was there. And, you know, at that point, he's Scottish. So I guess Protestant of some stripe or another, probably Church of England. And yet he's fighting in that neck of the woods. And it just, you know, it brings home again, learning all of this late as I did, what an entire global conflict it was. Because even though we call it World War One, I think a lot of us tend to only hear about what happened in Verdun and, you know, the trench warfare between the Germans and the French and the English part of all of that. But we forget that, yeah, I mean, the whole thing started in the Balkans. The Balkans, by the way, not the Baltics, you dumbass. Sorry, I was had a Trump moment there. Did you hear about that nonsense?
What now? What else did Fat Boy do?
He screwed up the Balkans and the Baltics because they both start with the same
because
three letters.
He's a fucking retard. That's why.
Right.
Jesus.
Right.
I mean, let's call a spade a spade. He may be the president, but he's a dick. I mean, he's a dumb fucking asshole.
Right. So. Anyway, yeah, but to have that sort of history behind it, it really does. It brings back that, yeah, there was a whole bunch of stuff going on in far-flung places around the globe, and it was the first time that that human beings really had the ability to do that. And, of course, what do? Take the excuse to kill 16 million people or something like that.
And, of course, who started the whole goddamn thing? Austria.
You're right.
Yet again. They did it first. And then they did it again by sending that little bastard, that fuck up of a painter, into Germany,
yep.
Create the Anschluss, and then, you know, Germany takes the fall for everything.
Yeah.
Has it not dawned on Germany yet that Austria bad?
Yeah, right. How about not starting shit when they try to goad you into it?
Exactly. Stop being so fucking German and dumb.
You know, but I think we may have left showbiz just a little bit too soon, though, because everybody, everybody has to have, everybody has to have a good celebrity story going on. And if it's a courtroom battle, all the more so. So now that Bill Cosby's little court battle is over with and he's in prison, or he should be, now we have another court battle shaping up, but this time it's a divorce court. What's going on?
It's Angelina Jolie versus Brad Pitt.
Oh, boy.
And all those fucking kids.
Yeah, all 130 of them.
Oh, God. You know what? I'm on Team Pitt. You go, Brad. Wipe the floor with her because she's fucking nuts.
That's got to be easiest job in the world for his attorney, because all he has to do is point at her and go, you realize that's Angelina Jolie, right?
And then, she may be smoking hot. She's fucking nuts.
Yep.
Okay, two words, case closed, you know? Let's call in her father, shall we? Let's call in Big John Voight.
How about we call in, ask Billy Bob Thornton what it was like to be married to her.
Yeah, I don't think he wants to. Don't bring him into this. He's living a nice life. Don't bring Johnny Lee Miller into this. He's living a nice life, you know? The only mistake that Johnny Lee Miller made, playing Sick Boy a second time.
Yeah.
You don't need to go in Spotter 2. Beyond that, just point at her and go, she's fucking nuts.
Yep.
That's all there is to it. You know, she fucked up that first kid of theirs, the kid that's a girl that looks like a boy or whatever the fuck it is. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, she's fucking nuts. End of story. Case closed. You know, I could be a goddamn lawyer. I should be a lawyer at this point. But okay, let's go back to music, because we do have stuff to talk about, and it's meaty, and it's good, and it's positive, and it's uplifting. We're talking about a couple of great record releases, one that came out, one that will be coming out, and one that I actually saw this past week.
Do tell.
Okay. I made my first foray into the new room at City Winery called The Loft. And this is a room specifically designed for low-key, low-voltage shows. And this Friday night, even though it was shitty and ugly and raining and cold in New York, it was the perfect venue and perfect setting to see a very rare and special performance by Peter Holzapfel and Christine.
Nice.
Together on stage, along with Dave Schramm, who was one of the best guitarists out there. He was adding texture and feel to some of the songs. When I tell you that they did a set that actually, it put tears in my eyes by the end of the show. I'm not joking. They did songs that, A, I never thought I'd ever see or hear done live, including my all-time favorite DB song, which is one of the most overlooked, you know, when people talk about the DBs. They always talk about Neverland and Love is for Lovers and Amplifier and Ask for Jill and Black and White or, you know, but they did From a Window to a Screen, which is just one of the most gorgeous things you've ever heard on record or otherwise, and they did it. But they also plumped from – they stayed pretty obscurely to the DB's canon. Interestingly enough, for all the DB's fans, they did from the DB's section of the show, they did From a Window, they did an acoustic version of Cycles Per Second, which is – not a song that lends itself to acoustic performance.
No, true.
Because it's weird. But they also did the magnificent Nothing Is Wrong off of Repercussion. I particularly love that song because I ripped it off to do the song Inside, which is subtitled Open Your Eyes, on the Punchline album. You know, that's the direct correlation between me writing a Big Star song by way of the DBs. So that song is very, you know, very set in my heart. But they opened up with Chris Stamey's Company of Light from his 1992 album Fireworks. Then they did a bunch of songs that came off of their 1991 album, the first Stamey Holzapfel album. They did She Was the One, which is one of the most beautiful things Peter Holzapfel ever wrote. But they also did some of the songs that were off of 2009's Here and Now, the title cut, which is such a joyful and uplifting and fun song. And Early in the Morning, which is also uplifting. They also did a powerhouse version. You're going to love this. A powerhouse acoustic version of Don't Mention the War.
That's great.
Peter's album Game Day. I mean, it was... there wasn't a dry eye in a house, but the thing is, the ones that brought me to my absolute knees were, didn't expect it, in the middle of the set, they started talking about one of their favorite bands when they were kids, because their friendship goes back 50-some-odd years now, The Love and Spoonful. Mm-hmm. And they did a gorgeous version of Darlin' Be Home Soon. But they closed the set shockingly, with a version of Let It Be Me.
Wow.
Which I wept. I cried because first of all, that song is highly personal to me on many levels. One, Carl, who was the bass player of the Punchline, and I used to do that song in our acoustic set because we'd always do Everly Brothers. And that song always was a big moment for us to do. That's number one. Number two, when I was dating and engaged to my former girlfriend / fiance, who is now no longer with us, that was going to be our wedding song. So it's a very emotionally powerful song for me to digest. No matter what, if I hear it in the car, either I'm going to listen to it and probably start crying along with it, or I'm going to change the channel because I just can't handle it. Mm-hmm. But they did it, and it was beautiful, and they were fantastic, and they made a warm, comfortable room even smaller and much more intimate. So apart from the fact that I'm just so grateful that I got to see them, I thank them for such an incredibly moving performance. It was a really special night. And I'm happy to say that there may be more of these type shows popping up in the future all over the place. And also the Peter Holzapfel combo, as they're known, is going out more on the road. So you may get to see them sooner than later. So that's number one. There will be a live review of that up on Rock NYC live and recorded within the next 24 to 48 hours. So look for that.
Good.
We have also a review and a preview. Now, the first one is a review of an EP from a band from Nashville, a trio called High South. Now, these guys have been around since 2015, going across Europe and trying to establish a name there. Now, You know how I bristle when I get press releases, especially when the press release does a comparison.
Yeah.
Now, here, the press release made a comparison with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the Doobie Brothers, the band, and the Eagles. Okay? Now, that's some pretty high stakes to be trying to compare this unknown trio to. But this EP called Change in the Wind, they did not, by any stretch of the imagination, exaggerate what they said in that press release.
Wow.
That is not a joke. That's not an overstatement. The opening track, Make It Better, the minute you hear it, you think this was on the first Crosby, Stills, and Nash album, wasn't it?
Right. But it's time to come together. Do or die now or never. Leave behind a light that shines forever. We can make it better. Packaged up. Civil rights, a screen test, we kept it black and white.
John, it is so dead on, and I mean dead on, it's frightening. The track Joshua Tree sounds exactly like it comes off of either music from Big Pink or the Brown album, The Band. The singer sounds like Levon Helm.
Wow.
And then the next two songs, Honestly and All I Want Is You, both of them come off of the first Eagles album and Desperado. These guys nailed it. They fucking nailed it perfectly. And I mean perfectly. And I don't have a problem with that because it's a warm and comfortable sound. And that says these guys have the skill. They've got the skill of the songwriting because they're all original songs, and they've got the vocal skills. They've got the gymnastics and the master of harmony down to a fine science. And they're young, so they're going to be able to do this for a while. And God bless them for doing it because they delivered. And I mean delivered. So by no stretch of the imagination, pass High South, Change in the Wind by. To check out and grab onto.
Definitely. And so let's talk about the flip side of that, though. I mean, because sometimes that can become distracting. If it's a little too much like something else, or it reminds you a little too much of something else, sometimes that can distract from a band finding their own voice, their own songs, because it sounds a little bit too much like all of the stuff that came before. Do they get lost in that, or are you able to separate it and appreciate it for what it is on its own?
For me, I was able to appreciate it for what it is because they're young guys and they've learned from the masters.
Great.
And they aimed for the sky and they reached it. You know, there are some times that you can want to sound like somebody, but you miss the mark completely.
Yep.
You know, like you can tell that they're trying to sound like somebody and you give them the A for effort, but a C plus for overall execution. Because it didn't quite get there. These guys get straight A's across the board.
Excellent. All right.
No mistake whatsoever.
And I know it wouldn't be a complete conversation if we didn't talk about something new that's coming out, because this, in particular, we get back to go back to your wheelhouse and talk about Big Star.
Yes, yes, yes. Rather than it being for the next Record Store Day, in January 25th, I believe, Omnivore, surprise, will be releasing Big Star live on WLIR. Now, this came out in part back in 1992 originally on Ryko Disc as Big Star Live. Okay, this is recorded for WLIR Radio back in 1974 when John Lightman had joined the band and they were out on their very last tour as a three-piece.
Mm-hmm.
These recordings are now restored and remastered from the original tapes. And they're going to get their first official release on vinyl as well. So you will have the extended CD package and a double LP coming out in January, along with liner notes by Robert Gordon and Rich Tupica. I mean, this is huge because it once again completes a part of the packages that have disappeared since Ryko Disc's demise. My hope is that at a point they will in fact also re-release Big Star in Space, the album, the 2004-2005 album that was Alex, Jody, and John and Ken from the Posies, Big Star Mark II.
Okay.
The Big Star that we had for ostensibly 17 years till Alex's death. You know, and it's a really good album that's criminally overlooked and violently underappreciated. So my hope is that sooner or later, Omnivore will release that as well, or re-release that as well. Remaster it, give it a deluxe package, and put it out on vinyl as well. So one lives in perpetual hope. So, you know, we have all of that to look forward to.
Good deal. Well, you know, I think that brings us up to In Our Heads, unless there's something I've missed.
Nothing I can think of off the top of my head, unless anything else in the news?
No, so pitter-patter, let's get at her. In Our Heads this week, I'm going to go back into, you know, it's come up a couple of times because part of it was referred to in that movie Bohemian Rhapsody that we talked about. And in a conversation with a buddy of mine this week, we ended up talking about Ram. The McCartney album, 1971. And the conversation started because, you know, here's a guy who is as musically knowledgeable as anybody that I know, present company excluded. And he said, you know, that album to me was McCartney as dialed in as he ever was. I mean, it was so locked into what he was doing at the time that it wasn't him thinking, okay, I've got to beat the other Beatles or anything like that. It was just McCartney going, you know what? I have the freedom. I am now going to do what I want to do, and I'm going to make it sound like I want to do it. And it, you know, he just nailed it. And I think that with the possible exception of the, you know, that era that you and I both love of Tug of War and Pipes of Peace, Ram is indicative of that. It's McCartney at his most locked in. If you like what he does, you're going to love that album. So in the Bohemian Rhapsody movie, they talk about Freddie going off to do his solo album and the problems that he had because he didn't have anybody to challenge him. McCartney didn't need that. Freddie needed the rest of the guys in Queen to challenge him and say, no, you don't just get to be this avant-garde horseshit. You know, there is a rock band that has to make an album here. And he needed that. So let's talk a little bit about guys who were famous and went off into their solo projects, where it happened and where it didn't happen. The times when it was either an artist finally getting to spread his wings, a la McCartney and Ram, or the times when it was somebody realizing, you know, I probably should have stayed with that band I was in.
All right, I'm going to start because I want to pick up a little bit on Ram. The thing about Ram is that when McCartney came out, the first solo album, people kind of nodded at it because it was to them, A, an ego stroke since he played all the parts himself.
Right.
And B, he had broken up the Beatles to the world's general point of view. So he wasn't exactly in favor. And although Another Day was a great first solo single, and it was a hit, people were thinking, okay, he's being too cutesy. Ram was something that he consciously said, I really tried hard to make a good album.
Yep.
And like you said, he was locked in and he was focused. Now, you can't tell me that's not a genius who constructs something like Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey. That's one of the greatest pieces of music by anyone. And you're absolutely right. He didn't need the other Beatles to challenge him. He brought in the best of the best players that were around at the time. You know, he brought in people like Hugh McCracken and Denny Sewell and you know, all these people to fashion this really solid album. And his playing on it, you know, his guitar work and his bass playing is just magnificent, you know. Were it not for the fact that it's actually credited as Paul and Linda McCartney rather than properly being credited Paul McCartney.
Right.
That's his first real solo album. I mean, the McCartney album is, to me, if you're going to play all the parts yourself, frankly, it's an album full of demos.
Pretty much.
I want either studio musicians or your bandmates there. But if you're playing all the parts, it's demos. Quality demos, albeit, but still demos. Now, the first one I'm going to take, when you've gone away from a band that you've had a track record with, Paul Weller. Because his first move away from the Jam was the Style Council.
Yep.
Now, I will say this much. I tried, because I was so devoted to him, that the first four Style Council singles and the first album, Café Bleu, were absolute magic. Because I saw it from the perspective I think he wanted us to see it. He had to get away from the jam. You take all the personal stuff aside, whatever it may have been at that time. He was 24 years old. You think about it in context. He was 24 years old, and he needed to start to shift his own musical direction. Otherwise, he would wind up on a treadmill like every other rock band does. You look at the Rolling Stones. When was the last time the Stones were remotely relevant, right?
Yeah.
He broke up a band that had gone beyond the perimeters of what he wanted to do musically. And with the Style Council, he was able to explore orchestral arrangements and soul music and funk and disco and more acoustic and folk-oriented things that he hadn't previously and could probably never have done in the framework and constrictions of the jam. But those first four singles and that first album aside, it turned into absolute gobbledygook because he lost the direction. He became too much of a caricature of himself. And he didn't find his own feet until his second proper solo album that, by the way, the first record that he did, the first Paul Weller solo album, it kind of started out precariously because the first single, which is actually very good, Into Tomorrow, was credited to the Paul Weller movement. He wasn't comfortable going out under his own name. Solo album, the self-titled Paul Weller, it's okay. It really wasn't anything to write home about. The first sign of the warrior coming back from, you know, the hinterlands with his, you know, with his troops behind him was the first single off of what would become the second album. The single was called Sunflower, and the second album was called Wildwood. My days, messing up my nights. Now we're up to the top of your head. Sun shower kisses, I feel the head. That album completely spun my head around a 360 because I frankly hadn't paid any attention to Paul Weller since about 1985 at that point. Now you're talking about 1993. And that says a lot,
yeah.
You know? From that point forward, all systems were go, you know? Now, yeah, his solo albums have been inconsistent. His thing is, I've noticed, is he puts out a so-so album, then a great album, then a so-so album, then a great album. You know, first album, so-so. Wildwood, amazing. Everybody loves Stanley Road. I don't. I find it kind of boring, even though that was his biggest one of all. But then he put out Heavy Soul, which I think is just as much of an ass kicker as Wildwood, you know? But the fact is, he regained his footing by his second solo album after a decade in another band, and I'm using the term very loosely, project, you know?
So where did it not happen? Who were some of the guys that just, or girls that just missed the mark entirely?
Well, Sting always lost the mark entirely. Sting, you know, Sting is a guy who, he writes a couple of great songs here and there. He writes memorable songs that you can't help but love. And I'm just as guilty as everybody else for buying every one of his solo records up to Sacred Love. But he's insufferable.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't know when to stop. He's also in dire need of an editor. You know?
Right, right.
I have to be honest. Bob Mould solo has been hit or miss at times. He came out of the box amazingly strong because he comes out of a band like Husker Du, which is as loud and as brash and as rapid fire machine gun powerful as possible. And he puts out this gorgeous album like Workbook. Then he starts to go down the dip with the second solo album, Black Sheets of Rain, even though my favorite of his solo songs, Out of Your Life, is on there. It sounds bad. It's just muddy and it's just too layered. And then he thankfully regrouped and started Sugar. And Sugar was an amazing band, but they only lasted through two albums. Then he was back to the solo records. He didn't find his footing again until I think Body of Song. But like Weller, he has these starts and stops. His problem is he's in dire need of an editor also. I mean, really, some of those lyrics are very heavy-handed and just at points downright painfully pretentious. He needs to know to reel himself in.
Right. Well,
he hits stride.
The same is true of Robert Plant. And I'm going to start with Robert Plant and go kind of in both directions with him, because when it comes to missing the mark, his first solo album after Led Zeppelin was Pictures at 11. And that album, I mean, Burning Down One Side is similar to what you just said about Bob Mould. Burning Down One Side is one of my favorite Robert Plant solo songs. However, the rest of that album I honestly have no use for whatsoever. However, the next album after that, you know, with the Principle of Moments, it's like all of a sudden he remembered, oh shit, I'm Robert Plant. You know, all of a sudden it was just like, bam, it's there again. Because, you know, while he had a tendency, even in the latter days of Led Zeppelin, to get a little dancey and start doing the more dance pop stuff, because it was the disco era and it was around. Queen did the same thing. But, you know, with songs like In the Mood and Big Log, and even some of the sort of what a lot of people, I guess, would probably consider album filler, like Reckless Love, I love that stuff. I think it sounded enough, you know, it was different enough from Led Zeppelin, certainly, but it was still delivered with the same vocal punch as he had in the latter stages of that band. It was just a little cleaner. It was a little more dialed into the time. I mean, because we're talking about 1985, I think. So it was clearly in that wheelhouse of mid-80s pop slash rock. And he carved out a niche for himself with that album that I don't think that he was, until, well, Now and Zen, I guess the next one that came out, or two down the road with Now and Zen.
Shaken and Stirred, I thought was a really good and different kind of album.
Yes, right. So
was that one on the heels of the Honey Drippers project?
Honey Drippers was, I think, 84.
I always thought like he basically revived himself by doing that.
Right.
No, I think that was kind of like, I need a breather. I got to do something different. Let me go into something comfortable.
Right. So Principle of Moments was 83. Honey Drippers was 84. Shaken and Stirred was 85. And then he didn't put out another one until Now and Zen in 88.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it was a good 3-year period. But then again, he had put out 4 albums in 4 years. So, you know, for a solo artist, not half bad. But there are some other ones. I mean, when you get into the absolute worst of the worst. Well, and Paul Simon. You know, back to the best of the best, Paul Simon, after he split with Art Garfunkel, did nothing but put out quality album after quality album after quality album, all the way up to and through Graceland. And even though he ripped off the last song on the album, it's an incredible piece of work. And then you have something like Roger Waters' Radio Chaos, which just is a mess. So...
I hate Roger Waters anyway.
So. Yeah. Well, yeah, but I mean, pros and cons of Hitchhiking was a good, solid record. Radio Chaos was nothing.
You know, it's kind of hard to think about some of these. I mean, like, look, Harrison came out of the box. Nobody expected him to hit the Grand Slam.
Yep.
By entering the fray technically, and I'm saying technically, with his first solo album being All Things Must Pass. I mean, yeah, electronic sound and Wonderwall. Wonderwall's a soundtrack, so that doesn't really count.
Right.
And electronic sound is just him fucking around with an old-fashioned Moog synthesizer, which gets really tedious after the first 2 minutes. All Things Must Pass was a triple album.
Right.
You know? That's an amazing statement right there.
But again, what did he do with that album? He brought in every sniper he knew, and he knew every sniper in the book at that point, you know? So he's hanging out with Eric Clapton and Harry Nilsson and all of these guys. And so they're all showing up on that record. Of course, that was lineup, great.
That lineup makes you want to come in your pants. I mean, you've got George, you've got Clapton, you've got Badfinger, you've got Leon Russell, you've got Billy Preston, you've got Ringo, you've got Phil Collins, you've got Bob Dylan, you've got co-production with Phil Spector.
Right.
I mean, fuck.
Not bad. Not bad.
Not bad at all. I think, what's his name? The drummer. Who's the drummer? Keltner.
Yes, right. Jim Keltner.
The greatest drummers in the world. The guys from Derek and the Dominoes were in there. I mean, Jesus fucking Christ. Ask for more?
Yeah, give me those guys. I'll make a great album.
You know, and he did carry on the quality into the next solo album, Living in the Material World, which wasn't bad. A little, you know, cutesy for my... But then Dark Horse came along and it was all down the hill from there. Yeah.
See, because, I like Dark Horse. I'm not a big fan of some of the other things that came out. Like, Gone Troppo is just a mess.
That's a forgettable album. 33 and a Third has its moments.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got Cracker Box Palace.
Right.
That's a nifty little song.
While growing up, we're trying to, not knowing where to start. I looked around for someone who may help reveal my heart. Someone said, while you're a part of Cracker Box Palace, do what the rest don't do. Or face the fact, the Cracker Box Palace may have no other choice than to deport you.
It's also got, was it, I think it's called This Song. It's a loving shot at Herb Alpert, because he got into a lawsuit with Herb Alpert because Dark Horse Records was originally distributed by A&M.
Yep.
And then when George himself didn't deliver 33 and a Third when he was supposed to, they sued him. So he said, fuck you. And he pulled up the umbrella and took Dark Horse over to the Brothers Warner instead and set up shop there. And that's when he started releasing his own stuff on that label.
Right. Well, and a couple of others just to give sort of honorable mention to. I will always take Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros, even though it's technically not a solo album, but it was not The Clash. And I will always take Warren Zevon, even though he kind of went the other direction. He went from being a solo act, being just Warren Zevon over the years, into Warren Zevon and the Hindu Love Gods.
That was kind of a gag band, though. That was just a fuck around, because if you remember,
it sounded good, though.
but you have the very first Hindu Love God single, "Gonna Have a Good Time," and Jacques Cousteau, because that's Brian Cook from Izod Gap and Time Toy on lead vocals.
Right,
he's a really great performer and singer, and of course nobody's ever heard either band unless you get the Athens GA Inside Out soundtrack, and then you can hear the Time Toy tracks, but. You know, that was just a band of fun and just, you know, throwing something together and throwing on the recording machine. You could make the argument, again, and it could be a good argument because it's coming from the Sting school of thought, Henley and Fry.
Yeah.
And Fry came out of the box a lot stronger than Henley did at the outset.
Right.
But it was Henley who, once he was on the track, he ran and won every fucking race. I mean, he didn't stop winning through, you know, Boys of Summer and All She Wants to Do Is Dance and just, you know, Heart of the Matter. I mean, just, Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah. And where did it start? Didn't it start with the song about the newsroom?
Well, Dirty Laundry.
Dirty Laundry.
Yeah. But, you know, Fry came out of the box with, the first solo album, No Fun Allowed.
Yeah.
You know, that was okay, but then all of a sudden, you know, come on, The Heat Is On, Yep. I blame him for that cheesy sax of the mid-80s.
Yeah.
The City. If I ever hear that, I'm going to kill somebody.
Smuggler's Blues.
Oh, Christ. But it served him well.
Yep. Yeah, sold a hell of a lot of records.
So there's something always to be said about the whole solo album thing away from a band. I mean, you know, when Freddie Mercury released Mr. Bad Guy, it went completely unnoticed.
Right.
And I think the only route you can take is with the heavy hitters. It really is. Look, there was a many year gap between. Here's a perfect example that strikes right to our collective heart. You know, Richard Barone was in the Bongos and then he wasn't, but he played with remarkable people who knew how to do what those songs needed to have done to, with, and for them.
Right.
So he never dropped the ball.
And that is the one thing that, and well, I guess we can end on this because this is the one thing that I will give to Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie, which is the fact that they made very clear that while Freddie Mercury was the lead singer, it's easy to fall into that trap to think, okay, so he was the songwriter too. Not necessarily. In fact, all of the members of Queen wrote songs on all of their albums and wrote hits on all of their albums. Brian May had his hits, and they all did. So
here's a perfect example, and I don't mean to cut you off, but what was the biggest hit of all time? Another One Bites the Dust.
Right.
Who wrote Another One Bites the Dust? John Deacon.
Back to the bass. So yeah, for that, I will give props to that movie, even though it wasn't a great movie. So we'll end it there. We'll look forward to our next visit here on Radio City. And Rob Ross, have a wonderful week, and we'll get together next time around.
Yes, indeed, brother, because next week is our pre-Thanksgiving show.
Yeehaw.
Favorite holiday. So anyway, have a fantastic week. Stay well, and keep me apprised of what's happening in Radio Land.
You got it.
All right, brother. See you later.